A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about Benjamin Netanyahu, not the politician, but the person. What do the people who actually know him say about his personality? Does the man have hobbies? And how has his vision of Zionism evolved over all these decades at the top? It's an interesting framing because most coverage treats him as a political force, not a human being. And honestly, the human part might explain more than any policy paper ever could.
There was a long profile in the New York Times Magazine last November that tried to answer exactly this. The writer spent months talking to former aides, family friends, people who've been in the room. The through line, and this came up again and again, is that Netanyahu is almost pathologically incapable of admitting error. One former staffer said he'd rather steer the entire ship into an iceberg than say, "I was wrong about the heading."
Which explains a lot about the last few years.
But here's the thing. It's not just stubbornness. People who know him describe it as something closer to a worldview. He genuinely believes that if he admits a mistake, the entire edifice crumbles. That the opposition, the media, the international community will pounce, and Israel will pay the price. So the inability to apologize isn't just ego. It's strategy. Bad strategy, arguably, but strategy.
Walk me through how that actually plays out in practice. Because every leader makes mistakes. What happens in the room when something has clearly gone wrong and everyone knows it?
That's the fascinating part. Former aides describe a very specific pattern. When a crisis hits, say, a diplomatic flap or a military operation that didn't go as planned, Netanyahu's first instinct isn't to assess what went wrong. It's to find who leaked, who criticized, who's spinning against him. The operational failure almost becomes secondary to the narrative war. One former communications advisor described it as watching someone immediately pivot from firefighter to arson investigator while the building is still burning.
The problem isn't the fire. The problem is who's saying there's a fire.
And if you're in the room, the conversation very quickly becomes who benefits from this story, rather than how do we fix this? It's a remarkably consistent pattern across multiple administrations and multiple types of crises. The focus is always on the perception of the mistake, never the mistake itself.
The mental list of enemies.
Ari Shabbat recounts this in his book, My Promised Land. Netanyahu once told an aide that he never forgets a slight. He keeps a running ledger. And Shabbat's take is that this isn't paranoia. It's a deliberate accounting system. Every perceived betrayal gets filed away and informs future decisions about who to trust and who to isolate.
Which means you're not dealing with a leader who processes setbacks and moves on. You're dealing with someone who treats political conflict as a permanent state of war on all fronts. The media is an enemy. The judiciary is an enemy. The international community is an enemy. And you don't negotiate with enemies, you defeat them.
That's the thread that connects the personal to the political. Ben Caspet, who wrote probably the most thorough critical biography, The Netanyahu Years, describes him as someone who has been in permanent campaign mode since the 1980s. There's no off switch. Former aides say he'll call them at 2 in the morning about a minor newspaper column. He personally approved every diplomatic cable during his second term, even the routine ones. A 2019 Haaretz profile documented this. Cables that any deputy minister could handle, and Netanyahu was line editing them.
Like a CEO who can't stop checking the cash register.
That's exactly the management style. Micromanagement to the point of paralysis. Former Ambassador Michael Oren, who served as his envoy to Washington, has written about this. Netanyahu would bypass the foreign ministry entirely and run his own parallel diplomacy through personal channels. Trusted almost nobody.
I want to pause on that, because the parallel diplomacy thing is wild when you think about the scale. Israel's foreign ministry has hundreds of trained diplomats, institutional memory going back to 1948, established channels with basically every country on earth. And Netanyahu just roots around it?
Oren described situations where he'd be in Washington, operating through the official embassy channels, and then discovered that Netanyahu had sent a personal envoy through a completely separate back channel to deliver a different message to the same American officials. The left hand didn't just not know what the right hand was doing. The left hand was actively being undermined by the right hand.
Which creates chaos, but it also creates dependency. If no one else has the full picture, no one else can operate independently.
That's exactly the dynamic, and it's not accidental. It's the same reason he's never groomed a successor, never built a deep bench, never created systems that could function without him. The chaos is a feature. It ensures indispensability.
Let's talk about where that comes from, because you don't get a personality like this in a vacuum.
You have to start with the father. He was a historian of the Spanish Inquisition, and not just an academic, but a polemicist who argued that the Inquisition wasn't really about religion. It was about racial anti-Semitism that predated Christianity in Spain. His thesis was that Jews are perpetually, existentially threatened by forces that wear different masks in different eras but never fundamentally change. And he raised his sons in that worldview.
Young Bibi grows up in a house where history isn't just study, it's a warning.
A warning and a mission. Bencian was a disciple of Zeev Jabotinsky, the founder of revisionist Zionism. Jabotinsky's big idea was the Iron Wall, that Jews would only achieve safety through overwhelming military strength, because Arabs would never voluntarily accept a Jewish state. Negotiation was pointless. Only when the Iron Wall was unbreachable would the other side finally come to terms. That's the intellectual DNA Netanyahu inherited.
To be clear, Bencian wasn't some armchair ideologue. He was active. He testified before Congress. He wrote polemics that got real attention. This wasn't dinner table philosophizing. This was a family business.
That's a crucial point. The Netanyahu household wasn't just intellectually intense. It was politically operational. Bencian saw himself as a warrior scholar, fighting a multi-front war against the dilution of Zionist purpose. And he brought that energy home. Multiple biographers describe a household where ideological debate wasn't recreation, it was training. You defended your positions or you got demolished.
Then his brother dies.
July 4, 1976. Yoni Netanyahu leads the assault team at Entebbe. They rescue 102 hostages. Yoni is the only Israeli soldier killed. He's 30 years old. Bibi is 26, and everything changes.
I've read that he said he barely slept for a year afterward.
He's described it as the event that split his life into before and after. Before Entebbe, he was a management consultant in Boston, living a comfortable expat life. After Yoni's death, he threw himself into counterterrorism work, founded the Jonathan Institute, which organized international conferences on terrorism, started building the network that would eventually launch his political career. The brother's death became the origin story and the fuel source.
Here's what I wonder. Did it also cement the worldview his father gave him? Because losing your brother to terrorists while rescuing hostages would seem to validate the idea that existential threats are everywhere, that strength is the only language that works, that the stakes are literally life and death.
It absolutely did. And people close to him say he has never, in 50 years, fully processed the grief. It's still there. It's in every security cabinet meeting. It's in every decision about military operations. It's in the way he talks about Iran. The brother who died saving Jews from terrorists in Africa becomes the lens through which every threat is evaluated.
There's a psychological concept here that I think is useful. Frozen grief. It's when a loss is so profound that the normal mourning process gets arrested. The person doesn't integrate the loss. They organize their life around it. Every decision becomes a response to the person who's no longer there.
That's exactly the read that multiple people who've studied Netanyahu have offered. The grief isn't processed, it's channeled. It becomes fuel. And the problem with fuel is that it burns until it's gone. It doesn't resolve, it just keeps combusting.
We've got a father who teaches that the world is permanently hostile. A brother who dies a hero confronting that hostility, and a personality that already trends towards suspicion and control. That's a potent combination.
Then you add the personal manner. And this is where the public image and the private reality diverge sharply.
The public image being what? The master communicator. The guy who can work a room in perfect English.
And he is that. His English is extraordinary, idiomatic, precise, capable of shifting registers from folksy to academic in the same sentence. he can do the American Sunday shows and sound more articulate than the hosts. That's real. But people who've spent time with him in private settings describe someone who is profoundly uncomfortable with personal interaction. Aloof is the word that comes up constantly. He doesn't do small talk. Former aides say dinners with him are excruciating. Long silences, zero interest in asking about your family or your weekend. One former staffer told The New Yorker last summer that working for Netanyahu felt like working for a brain in a jar, all intellect, no warmth.
Which is fascinating because politics usually selects for people who are at least performatively warm. You have to fake it if you don't feel it.
He doesn't fake it well in private. The performance is for cameras and microphones. Once those are off, the energy apparently just drains out of the room. Ari Shavit describes him as someone who relates to people as instruments. Are you useful to the mission, or are you not? If you're useful, you're in the circle. If you're not, you don't exist.
I want to push on that a little, because the brain in a jar image is so vivid. Does that mean he's purely analytical, or is there emotional content there that's just...
The reporting suggests it's not that he doesn't have emotions, it's that the emotions are reserved for the mission, not for people. He can get angry about a news leak, he can be visibly moved by a military ceremony, he's not a sociopath. But the emotional bandwidth for individual human connection. Asking how your kid is doing, remembering that your mother was sick, that seems to be almost entirely absent. It's not malice, it's just not where his attention goes.
Where does Sarah fit into this?
Sarah Netanyahu is, by all accounts, the one person he trusts completely. And that trust is operational. She's not just a spouse, she's a gatekeeper. Former aides describe her as the final filter. If you want to get to Bibi, you go through Sarah. If Sarah doesn't like you, you're done. And she has strong opinions about who gets access.
There's been reporting about her influence on staffing decisions.
Multiple former aides have described her as effectively a personnel director for the Prime Minister's office. She vets appointments. She weighs in on political strategy. During the corruption trial, there was testimony about her demanding gifts from billionaires. The champagne, the jewelry. She's not a background figure. She's a central player.
That's centralization of trust. It's consistent with the personality we've been describing. If you believe the world is full of enemies and you can't trust anyone, then your spouse becomes not just a partner, but the only safe harbor.
That's exactly how people close to them describe the dynamic. It's the two of them against the world. Everyone else is a potential betrayer.
It also creates a kind of organizational bottleneck, right? If all trust flows through two people, and one of them is the Prime Minister, you basically created a system where nothing can scale. Every decision has to pass through a single marital unit.
That's been one of the persistent criticisms of Netanyahu's management style, that it creates gridlock. Decisions that should be made at the deputy minister level get escalated. People who should have autonomy don't. The system becomes a funnel that narrows to a single point, and that point can only process so much. During crises, aides describe a situation where everything stops because the only person authorized to decide is also the only person who needs to be in 17 other places at once.
Let's shift gears. When this man is not running the country, not fighting with the judiciary, not managing a war, what does he actually do? Does he have hobbies?
He does, and they're revealing. History is the big one. He's a voracious reader of military history and political biography. Churchill is the obvious touchstone. He's written about Churchill. He quotes Churchill constantly. He clearly sees himself in the Churchillian mold of the lonely leader standing against the tide.
Which is a comparison that works until you remember Churchill lost an election right after winning a war and spent years in the wilderness.
I don't think that part of the Churchill story gets as much attention in the Netanyahu household. But yes, the history reading is genuine and deep. People who've visited his residence describe a personal library that would make a university professor jealous. He doesn't just collect books. He reads them, annotates them, argues with them.
It's not just Churchill. I've read that he's deeply interested in the Spanish Inquisition, unsurprisingly, given his father's work, but also in ancient military history. There's apparently a well-worn copy of Thucydides in that library.
The Peloponnesian War. And if you want to understand how Netanyahu thinks about international relations, Thucydides is the key. The Melian Dialogue. The strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must. That's not just a classical reference for him, that's a working assumption about how the world operates. international law, diplomatic norms, multilateral institutions. These are thin veneers over the permanent reality of power politics, and anyone who thinks otherwise is naive.
Which makes him a realist in the international relations theory sense. Not a neoconservative idealist who thinks democracy solves everything, but someone who thinks power is the only currency that ultimately matters.
That's an important distinction. The neoconservative label gets applied to him because of his American alliances, but his actual worldview is more Hobbesian. It's not that he thinks democracy is bad. He clearly values it for Israel, but he doesn't think it's a magic wand. The world is dangerous. Power is the only guarantee, and anyone who tells you different is selling something.
Then there are the cigars.
This is where the personal and the legal collide. Netanyahu is a known aficionado of Cuban cigars, Cohibas specifically, and this became a central piece of the corruption trial. Case 1000, as it's known, involved allegations that he and Sarah received hundreds of thousands of shekels worth of cigars and champagne from billionaire benefactors, primarily Hollywood producer Arnon Milchan and Australian casino mogul James Packer.
The champagne was pink, if I remember correctly.
Pink champagne, yes. And the testimony got very specific brands, specific quantities, specific delivery dates. Milchan testified that Netanyahu would call him directly and request cigar resupplies. The defense argued this was just friendship, wealthy friends giving gifts to wealthy friends. The prosecution argued it created a quid pro quo relationship where Milchan expected help with his business interests.
Setting aside the legal question, what does the cigar thing tell us about the man?
I think it tells us a few things. One, he has expensive tastes and he's not shy about indulging them. Two, he moves in circles of extreme wealth and seems comfortable with the trappings. Three, and this is the psychological read, there's something about the ritual. The cigar is a marker of contemplation, of deliberation, of the statesman taking his time with a weighty decision. It's an accessory to the persona he's cultivated.
The Churchill thing again.
Churchill had his cigars. Netanyahu has his. It's not subtle.
Though Churchill, from everything I've read, was a genuine hedonist who enjoyed his cigars, his brandy, his food. He wasn't performing for anyone. He just liked pleasure. With Netanyahu, there's a question of whether the enjoyment is authentic or whether it's part of the construction of the self-image.
And I'm not sure anyone who's written about him has a clear answer. The people who've seen him smoke describe someone who savors the experience. This isn't someone puffing for the cameras. But with a personality this controlled, the line between authentic enjoyment and cultivated persona gets blurry. Maybe it doesn't even matter. If you've been performing a role for 40 years, at some point the performance is who you are.
What about fitness? I've read he's a disciplined runner.
He runs regularly, even during crises. During the 2014 Gaza War, Aides reported him maintaining his exercise routine. He's also reportedly careful about his diet, or at least he was before the cigars and champagne became public knowledge. The fitness discipline is interesting because it's another manifestation of the control orientation. His body, like his government, is something to be managed and optimized.
Then there's the health disclosure, the prostate cancer.
That was 2024, and it was unusual for him. Netanyahu has been famously secretive about his health for decades. There were years of speculation about various conditions, hospital visits that went unexplained, rumors that swirled in the Israeli press. And then he voluntarily disclosed the cancer diagnosis and the treatment plan. Very un-Netanyahu behavior.
Why do you think he did it?
I think there are a few possibilities. One is that the political calculus shifted. Maybe his advisors told him that transparency would play better than the inevitable leaks. Another is that at a certain age, he's in his mid-70s. Health disclosures become less of a vulnerability and more of a relatability play. The prime minister is human. He gets sick like everyone else. And a third possibility is that he simply couldn't hide it. The treatment required visible recovery time. Better to control the narrative.
That last one feels the most Netanyahu. Control the narrative. All right, let's move to the third piece of this, his Zionism. Because you mentioned Jabotinsky and the Iron Wall, but Netanyahu's ideology hasn't been static over 40 years. How has it evolved?
The best way to track it is through his major speeches. In 1996, his first term, he gives a speech at the Knesset where he explicitly quotes Jabotinsky's Iron Wall essay. The message is clear. peace through strength, no concessions without security guarantees, deep skepticism of the Oslo process. He's the young, hawkish prime minister who campaigned against Oslo and now has to govern in its shadow.
To remind listeners, Oslo wasn't just some diplomatic agreement. This was the handshake on the White House lawn. Rabin and Arafat. The beginning of Palestinian self-rule. It was the defining Israeli political divide of the 1990s, and Netanyahu was on the opposition side of that divide.
Vocally, consistently, and effectively, his entire political rise was built on opposing the Oslo framework. He argued that it was a security disaster in the making, that it gave away tangible assets, land, security control, in exchange for intangible promises. And when he became prime minister in 1996, the question was whether he'd tried to dismantle Oslo entirely or just slow it to a crawl.
The answer was...
slow it to a crawl. He didn't tear up the agreements. The international pressure would have been overwhelming, but he reinterpreted them in the most restrictive possible way. Every commitment became conditional. Every timeline got extended. The Hebron Agreement happened on his watch, but it was negotiated under duress, and he sold it to his base as damage control, not progress.
Then Bar-Ilan, 2009.
This is the pivot that confuses everyone. Netanyahu stands at Bar-Ilan University and says the words, two-state solution. He accepts the principle of a Palestinian state, with conditions, with caveats, with a demand for demilitarization and recognition of Israel as a Jewish state. But still, he says it. The man who built his career opposing Palestinian statehood just endorsed it.
Which he later walked back.
And that's the pattern. The Bar-Ilan speech was arguably a tactical move. It bought him diplomatic cover with the Obama administration, reduced international pressure, allowed him to govern without constant confrontation over settlements. But as the political winds shifted rightward in Israel, and as his coalition became more dependent on settler parties, the two-state language faded. By 2015, he was campaigning on the promise that no Palestinian state would be established on his watch.
Was the Bar-Ilan speech a genuine evolution that he later retreated from, or was it always a tactical feint?
This is the great debate among Netanyahu watchers. Ben Caspit argues it was always tactical, that Netanyahu never believed in Palestinian statehood and said what he needed to say to manage the Americans. Others, including some former U.S. officials who negotiated with him, believed there was a window where he was considering a more pragmatic approach, but the regional instability after the Arab Spring and the rise of Hamas made him retreat to his default position.
I'm inclined toward the tactical explanation, given everything we know about his personality. A man who keeps a mental list of enemies doesn't have ideological conversions. He has strategic adjustments.
That's the Occam's razor red. But I think it's worth noting that even a tactical adjustment represents some kind of evolution. The Netanyahu of 1996 would never have even uttered the words Palestinian state. The Netanyahu of 2009 did. Something shifted, even if it was just his calculation of what was politically survivable.
What about the American dimension? His relationship with neoconservatism?
This goes back to his time at MIT in the 1970s. He studied management and political science there, but more importantly, he built relationships with the emerging neoconservative movement. Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, these were his intellectual peers. They shared a worldview, American power is a force for good, the Middle East needs to be reshaped through strength, and Israel is a frontline state in a civilizational conflict.
That network became politically useful.
When Netanyahu was a young diplomat at the Israeli embassy in Washington in the early 1980s, he cultivated these relationships deliberately. He understood American politics better than almost any Israeli politician of his generation. He knew how to work the think tank circuit, how to get op-eds placed, how to appear on American television as the articulate English-speaking face of Israeli security concerns.
He was doing this at a time when most Israeli diplomats were still operating in a much more traditional mode, working through official channels, deferring to the foreign ministry, treating American Jewish organizations as the primary constituency. Netanyahu realized that the real power in Washington wasn't just in the State Department. It was in the think tanks, the op-ed pages, the Sunday shows.
He was essentially running an American-style media operation before anyone else in Israeli politics understood what that meant, and it gave him an enormous advantage. When he spoke, American audiences heard someone who sounded like them, who understood their political idioms, who could make Israel's case in terms that resonated with American conservative values. It's not an exaggeration to say he reshaped how Israel communicated with the American public,
which culminated in the 2015 Congress speech,
the Bibi bomb, as some called it. Netanyahu addresses a joint session of Congress to oppose the Iran nuclear deal, invited by Speaker Boehner, not by the White House. It's an extraordinary breach of diplomatic protocol. A foreign leader using the American legislature to undermine the American president's signature foreign policy initiative, and he delivered it flawlessly.
Dozens of standing ovations.
Something like 26 standing ovations. The speech was a tactical masterpiece and a strategic disaster rolled into one. In the short term, it rallied opposition to the Iran deal and cemented his reputation as a world-class communicator. In the long term, it made the Iran deal more partisan, damaged the U.S.-Israel relationship, and arguably made it harder to build the kind of bipartisan consensus that had sustained Israeli security for decades.
From his perspective, it was worth it.
From his perspective, preventing a nuclear Iran was the overriding mission. Everything else was secondary. And that's the Iron Wall doctrine in action. If you believe the threat is existential, you don't worry about hurt feelings or diplomatic niceties. You do whatever it takes.
You can see the logic. If you believe that a nuclear Iran represents an existential threat, not a regional problem, not a proliferation concern, but an actual threat to the continued existence of the Jewish state, then burning some diplomatic capital in Washington is a trivial price to pay.
The question is whether the speech actually made preventing a nuclear Iran more or less likely. And there's a reasonable argument that it made it harder, that by turning the Iran deal into a partisan issue, he ensured that Democrats would close ranks around it, that the deal would go through without Republican support, and that when the U.S. eventually withdrew from the deal under Trump, there was no bipartisan consensus for what came next.
That's a counterfactual we can't resolve here. The point for our purposes is that the speech was a perfect expression of the personality we've been describing. The willingness to go it alone, the conviction that he knows better than the experts, the framing of a policy disagreement as an existential struggle.
Which brings us to the current moment. How would you characterize where his Zionism stands today? I'd call it conflict management as doctrine. The explicit goal is no longer to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but to manage it indefinitely. Maintain security control, expand settlements when possible, degrade Hamas and Hezbollah when necessary, and wait for the regional and global conditions to shift in Israel's favor. The Abraham Accords were the model, normalize relations with Arab states without making concessions to the Palestinians. October 7, 2023 shattered that framework. Conflict management failed catastrophically. The whole premise was that Hamas was contained, that the border was secure, that the status quo was sustainable. And in a single morning, that premise collapsed. The war in Gaza that followed is, in some sense, an attempt to restore the credibility of the conflict management approach through overwhelming force.
The man at the center of it is the same man we've been describing. The micromanager who can't admit mistakes. The strategist who trusts almost no one. The leader who believes he's indispensable.
That's why the personal and the political can't be separated, even though that was the premise of the prompt. His personality isn't a footnote to his policies. It is the policy, the centralization of power, the suspicion of institutions, the preference for unilateral action over diplomacy, the framing of every challenge as existential. These aren't just political choices. They're expressions of who he is.
Where does that leave us? What's the takeaway for someone trying to understand this figure beyond the headlines?
I think there are three things. First, the indispensability belief is real and it's consequential. When Netanyahu says he's the only one who can keep Israel safe, he believes it. And that belief has shaped Israeli governance for a generation. It's why he's never groomed a successor, why his Likud party has become a personality cult, why the institutions around him have atrophied. Second, his Zionism is more adaptive than his critics admit, and more rigid than his defenders claim. He's not a static ideologue. He's adjusted to changing circumstances repeatedly. But the adjustments have all been within the same fundamental framework, Israel as a fortress. Strength is the only language that works, and Palestinian statehood as a threat to be managed rather than a goal to be pursued. Third, the brother. You cannot understand this man without understanding that he has spent 50 years trying to live up to a dead hero. every security decision, every speech about existential threats, every moment of intransigence. Somewhere in the background is a 26-year-old who lost his brother and decided that his life's purpose was to prevent it from happening to anyone else.
That's the tragedy of it, really. The thing that made him effective is also the thing that makes him incapable of the kind of political imagination that peace requires. The Iron Wall isn't just a doctrine, it's a psychological cage.
The question for Israel, as it looks toward a post-Netanyahu future, is whether the cage outlasts the man.
For listeners who want to go deeper, Netanyahu's own memoir, Bibi My Story, came out in 2022. It's fascinating, but it's also a political document. Read it alongside Ben Caspit's The Netanyahu Years for the critical counterweight. Ari Shavitz, My Promised Land, has an excellent chapter on him, and that New York Times Magazine profile from last November is probably the best single piece of journalism on his personality.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, a prominent Russian musicologist proposed that the dutar, a two-stringed lute from Tajikistan, was the original ancestor of all plucked string instruments worldwide, tracing its lineage through Central Asian trade routes to the Chinese pipa, the Arabic oud, and eventually the European lute and guitar. He spent decades promoting this theory before it was quietly abandoned as evidence for independent invention mounted.
I don't know what to do with that.
Carrying the weight of all string civilization. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who thinks they've got BB figured out. They probably haven't. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.